the interview with Dana Shrupp on July 27, 2005. So, Dana, you were just telling us about making the bomb runs and turning the controls over to your bombardier, and with all the flak and everything, you had to kind of stay on target.
And you couldn't change your altitude unless everybody changed. Now, I remember one time we went in on, I don't know where it was at, I think it might have been Frankfurt, but it was down deep. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we had more flak than any dude, so they lifted. We changed the altitude from 25,000 to 30,000.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
which meant that poor old 70s are struggling to get that altitude, because it's hard.
Well, yeah, and you're a lumbering old plane.
They're a lumbering old plane, they're heavy, and your manifolds, you don't get the manifold pressure you need to get the power. But you'll struggle up there. But when changing the altitude that we were going in on, at least we bunged up the guns.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were all zeroed in on an altitude.
Sure.
And you didn't know that. Of course, we also had another thing going. We called it G, chaff and G.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was little strips of aluminum, like mm-hmm. little Christmas tree ornaments, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We had sacks of it, mm-hmm. and we had a chute right on the side of a car. And usually somebody in one of the waste gunners would feed this stuff through, and there's that grass up there, scopes.
Okay.
So you just give them a grassy scope, and so you hope that they
wouldn't get that good at you.
Get that accurate to.
Well, did you get hit quite a few times?
Well,
we had
shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
We had one 88, we think it was an 88 millimeter, went right through the main truss of the wing,
mm-hmm.
where it attached to the light. But we just heard it go through. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it was altitude.
Uh-huh.
Sensitive. In other words, it didn't go on contact. It was an altitude fuse,
mm-hmm.
and we could hear the rain coming back down. But we didn't realize that we had that much of a hit. But we did find out afterwards that we had lost our oxygen, which meant that you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Because you got to get down. You can't stay up there. And then when you start to get down, that's when your problems start, because you're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
While you're in that squadron and in that flying formation,
sure.
you've got a tremendous firing power, you know.
Sure, with all the
coverage. And they put the chin turrets on those 17s, which eliminated the frontal attacks, which had been giving them fits.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried to make things pretty good for us all the time. So my first mission, I just started looking at it. It was probably in Frankfurt, I think it was in.
Frankfurt first, so you went deep.
That
right
was
away.
Deep. That was in quite deep.
Yeah.
But we were doing 10-hour missions. Mm-hmm. You never had the opportunity to be on oxygen
for 10 hours. You know what a dry mouth is.
Because you think how you see this. You know, talk.
Yeah, that's right. And after 10 hours of sucking,
I was sucking it.
But a lot of your missions were close to that time period.
Oh, yeah. Well, they ran from, mm-hmm. some of the longer ones were 10 hours,
mm-hmm.
some of them were 8. But you always had just enough gas, supposedly, to get there
and get back.
And get back.
Mm-hmm.
And the bomb load was accordingly. In other words, they knew they put as many bomb loads as they thought they bombs on as they thought they could get. You could get into the target group.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes you ran out of gas.
Oh,
you know, you didn't make it. So that's when you landed someplace else. Went down in the sea.
So went down in the channel.
But
you didn't have it. You always made it back okay.
Well, we went down channel once. Yeah,
you did go in the channel once?
Well,
that
two engines shot out.
Okay. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that
experience? Coming across Kiel.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of what we call them pocket battleships. German pocket battleships. And Kiel is where the sub-pens were.
Oh, that's where the submarine nest was.
And they hated people to go in there and start laying bombs in close so they get some of the ships around there.
Mm-hmm.
But, keep you on straight now.
Keep you away from there.
Keep you away from there. And we just got a, something looked like a 3-gun battery, and just, we could see you tracking us, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, when it starts tracking you, that's when you're, somebody's, everybody's hollering, let's get out of here, let's change, move, oh, come down, get out of here. So we ended up going into the North Sea there.
Mm-hmm.
And, we set, well, we got out of the airplane, all right.
Mm-hmm.
We had one guy that we had to pick up and bring along with us. And we sat out in those life rafts, 10-man, 5-man life rafts. There's two rafts out of each.
You appreciated your training in 30 seconds.
30 seconds, you knew that was. However, the thing, man, thing stayed up for about a minute and a half before it sank.
Yeah, it did stay up.
And man, it was cold.
Oh, yeah. What time of the year was it?
November.
November, oh, God.
The 13th of November.
Friday the 13th of November.
Ever since that time, I thought how lucky I was. Somebody said we weren't very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
We were lucky to be alive.
Yeah.
And I met my wife on the 13th.
No, oh, so 13th's been a good
one. And we used to drink a shot for each man on the crew. Whenever we could find it, finding the 13th. That kind of went by the wayside, too, over the years.
Yeah, the whole crew, then you drug them, and the whole crew got in the rafts. How long before they picked you up?
About an hour and a half.
When we did get in the picture.
And
that
we were almost close enough to shore that they had to send some new ones out from the bases in, and off the coast. The ones that were monitoring the bomber stream out further were too far out for us. They were monitoring from Kiel on in. So we just didn't. And it was cold. Yeah. And nothing. Well, the one gunner had a piece of shrapnel through his wrist and blew out the side, took his whole elbow off. And he was probably the worst off. Mm-hmm. However, he's still alive today.
Mm-hmm.
Took him into the hospital. And it's not like the New Memphis Belle, it's like the older one.
Mm-hmm.
He had to get him down to where he could breathe and the air and all over. So it's a whole mixed mass of all the stuff that you got to do if you have to abort or leave the bomber stream.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're hedge hopping across across France, hoping that nobody's going to get you.
They see you coming.
Then
you got another plane, and you had to add some crew members.
And it's amazing how many, we call them bastard gunners. A lot of guys have been kicked off a cruise, acting, stealing a truck and going to town and things like that, And if you weren't careful, you'd end up with some of these bastard gunners. Your bunch is gone,
You needed somebody reassigned,
to be reassigned to you. But
understand, it wasn't Creole. We were short. They got reassigned. Oh, my God. You got what everybody else didn't want.
That's right.
So that's what you picked up,
that's
a few
what you
of those.
Up when you went out there,
So you got another plane assigned to you there, and then you kept on flying.
Well, since we haven't been going then.
Yeah, so how many missions in total did you fly then?
17.
17 total.
And then we had two Mercy missions. Well, four Mercy missions. Two of our Mercy missions were what we call Child Mercy. And what we were doing was hauling food to the Dutch, one to Amsterdam and one to Rotterdam.
Okay.
And we went in with B-17s with wooden plywood on the bomb bay doors, so that when you open the door, everything would fall out that was in it, but the plywood kept everything off away from the frame.
Oh, okay.
So that when you opened it up, it
just
fell out. And of course, we found out that some of those packages had chocolate in them.
Of course.
We were always looking for cheese and chocolate.
Good
trading stuff.
Yeah, I bet it was at that time.
And then the other one was, we were hauling prisoners out of Linz and Graz, Austria. And we went in there right after the Russians liberated the Austrians area.
Uh-huh.
And they had a whole bunch of people that had been prisoners from North Africa, 41.
Oh my gosh.
And so they'd been on farms and terrible shape. A lot of them had just money crutches or whatever they kind of limb they'd make a crutch.
Put the paper down so here. So a lot of them were on crutches and the whole works. Good. These were U.S. prisoners from home.
Oh, they were French and English.
French and English.
Mostly French.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then we hauled them to, it was called Chantilly. It's Orly Airport now, but it was Chantilly. And let them out.
Uh-huh.
People stand around, waving, bad-handed. Do you think you can get a bottle of wine from anybody?
No. No.
They had the people bail with you.
Oh, dear, we got our folks back now.
We made two of those missions.
How many could you haul on a...
We had
30.
30. We'd get 30 in
there. 30 in them.
Give them a coffee can.
Mm-hmm. That's what they sat on.
No, that's what they spit in.
That's what they spit in. When they threw up. Got sick. What did they sit on? The
B-17? They just sitting on the floor.
Sit on the floor.
Oh, whatever happened to you, stand down.
They didn't care.
They didn't care. Mm-hmm. They were going home.
Yeah, right. So.
And some of those people from 41 to 45, that's a long way.
That's a long way, yes.
And of course, every time you landed, everybody wanted to know if you had some of their people on
board. I'm sure that would be case.
And I think that we moved an awful lot of prisoners in that 2 weeks that we were there. We only went two missions.
But with all the other planes that they had, so.
That's
the way they got a lot of those prisoners back.
That's how they got them back fast.
And
that's the thing that we wanted to do, is to get them back, because the people that were waiting for them and put an outfit to recover, they had to do that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And then, see, at that time, where did the Russian territory stop? The Russians have Austria all at that time? Or they had all of Austria? So they let you in and out?
We moved in to Graz the first time, there was soldiers there. Russia just got through.
Yeah, just wiped everybody out.
We always got to have a curious American, you know. Over there, wanting to get something off one of those stupid dive bombers were in the old airport there.
Uh-huh.
And so, someone's over there. The next thing we know, sky high the guy went. I had to go to another dumb American. I waited until everybody else had been on this one plane, and I went up with my knife and I cut the half of the swastika out of the tail.
Mm-hmm.
I brought it home.
You were able to get it home with you then.
But I was wanting to make sure that
it wasn't booby trapped anymore. That's right. That was always a risk, I guess. So you always flew out of England until...
Always flew out of England.
And how long did you stay on afterwards after you did the mercy missions and that sort of thing?
Oh, I think that we started home in the middle of June.
Middle of June of 45.
And we were the first outfit back to the States. And we flew back. And we brought with us our whole complement of brown people, too.
Well, you did. You brought the whole group.
So we had our brown engineer, maintenance man,
So that's the way they...
And that's how they did it, the 20 people in each airplane,
going home.
And we had our own crew, and plus the 20.
So that got the people out of England.
Get them out. Get them back.
Sure.
Everyone
wanted to go home. Plus, were you people in position then to get...
We thought we were all ready for the Pacific before we got home.
Okay, before you got home.
Transition you into a V-29, nothing to it.
Sure.
It was the same as your 17, except you got a few more gadgets.
A few more gadgets, a little bigger outfit. A little bigger outfit to get off the ground. But you never did you ever get that far to work the training on V-29s? Well, it was over with in August, so...
I always remember I had my instructor, instrument instructor, mm-hmm. and taught us instruments in, mm-hmm. in that advanced where I was in Lubbock. Mm-hmm. He was having all kinds of problems at home. Mm-hmm. And so he was giving us a short shift when he got us up to teach us, you know, to check it
sure.
out. And we were really unhappy because we didn't think we were getting enough to mm-hmm. pass the thing. Mm-hmm. So once we went over and talked to the test pilot and said, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think we're getting the kind of instrument training we need. And he said, well, I'll fly with you. So here you are, flying with a man that could give you an E-ride or teach you some instruments. And that's what he did. And then when I came back, I went back to you one day. I was flying a B-25 out of California, Warburg. Mm-hmm. And I flew it into Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And I went into the DX commissary thing there. Guess who I run into? My old instrument pilot. And he's now flying the B-29, and he knows where he's going. They were still flying.
Oh, yeah.
No, they were flying a lot. They thought we could just transition us.
Yeah. They were doing lots of missions.
They were doing lots of missions. So. Mm-hmm. And I was headed for California when D-Day, BJ
Day. When they dropped the big bomb.
Yeah. I ended up coming from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which was our rallying point after Quebec. Mm-hmm. Overseas, and the whole outfit was spread out. And so we came down to go to Long Beach mm-hmm. on the airplane, I mean, a train. And we pulled into Salt Lake City Sunday morning after the DJ day, and all the celebrating had been going on.
And you missed it all.
Salt Lake didn't have anything open.
Not Salt Lake.
First place it could have been, looking for something to drink on
Sunday. Salt Lake was not a place
for
celebration.
We'll get to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Navy had just tore San Francisco apart the day before, so they didn't give a hoot at the military game anywhere near them after that. But it was all right.
Well, then how long did you stay in?
I stayed in until 46.
Oh, 46.
And then I re-enlisted into the reserve, and I stayed through, and I didn't leave the reserve until 72. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of active duty in there.
In that part, you were in the reserves too. Well, if you stayed in through 46, what all things did you do then after the war was over?
Well, I flew C-54s, mm-hmm. Hamilton, that's a four engine. And we were flying it as an air sea rescue.
Oh, okay.
And we carry a little boat underneath, you know, mm-hmm. and jump it up for somebody in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I did that, and then I flew for the Air Transport Command
mm-hmm.
for a while. And then I came back in school.
Did you decide then that you were going to get out of the act? He'd had enough.
Well, I was getting kind of what do you want to say, CS?
Yeah. So, so then you got out, you came back to school. But you signed up for the reserve then.
Oh, yeah, I stayed in the reserve.
And on active duty, what kinds of active duty did you do?
Well, I was an information officer and training officer. I used to mm-hmm. teach instruments at Great Falls.
Okay.
I also worked with the rescue, escape and evasion stuff, mm-hmm. you know, where mm-hmm. there were people there. And I'd come down and I'd set up a rendezvous stuff for the Air Force Unit. I was working as an operations officer for a turnaround airplane. In other words, if we got into a disaster, mm-hmm. people had to leave Great Falls.
Okay.
Grand Forks, one of those places where they were based.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would send them out to the little bit. So we had to catch it at Helmer Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a unit there, which was a rescue officer. And we stayed there for what, 5 years? Finally walked it out. McNamara came along, and that was the end
of that. That. They didn't call you up for Korea out of the reserves.
No, they didn't run back to the Khrushchev was banging it.
Oh, yeah, when he was beating the door in Cuba.
Cuba, you were alerted.
Yeah.
But you were always on 24
hours. Sure, they're always subject being called up, so.
But then, I was in D.C. when Korea rolled around. Uh-huh. I was going to school there. Sitting right under your nose, nobody ever caught up with you. They knew what my address was, but I guess they didn't need it. They didn't need me that bad.
And then you were also a recruiter for the Air Force Academy.
Yeah, I was a recruiter from 1957
till 72.
Got to know a lot of young kids from Montana. One time I had 9 kids in the Air Force Academy.
Well, when you came back to school, did you change your major or what you wanted to do
from what you were doing before you went? Yeah, I had a fellow who was in Smith Hughes, what do you call it? Vocational.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what you were taking.
We didn't see eye to eye. Mm-hmm. I said, I think I'm going to do an extension. I said, well, I don't think you're going to want to stay here very long. No, that's right. So I got my degree in animal industry.
Okay.
In animal husbandry, I guess we call it that.
But when you started school before the war, you were planning on
being
going. Okay, so you didn't really change. You came back to the
same area. I didn't know
what
the chance of it ever being a county at that time. I had no idea.
Of course not.
But after I got in, I'd be around Scotty. He was my lifesaver.
Is that right?
Okay. I'd run out of money. Don't do it, Chuck. Here, here's $5.
Yeah.
I got another.
So you had $5. a full career of how many years with extension, then?
I had 35
with extension.
And I had almost 40 with the military.
Right? Sure, by the time you finished up. But you were. Yeah, okay, now let me see. I'll shut this. Did you get Dana as part of the service?
Got an air medal and that. And with a oak leaf cluster on for so many missions, and you get a cluster for so many
missions.
And so I got that. And then, believe it or not, I had a good conduct.
Oh, yeah, good conduct, my lighthouse helps. They give you anything special for having to ditch into the North Sea?
No. Reserve in Hamilton Field.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got, then I did a lot of work from here. Then I was attached to Air Guard, or the Army Guard in Helmer, as an Air Force Blue, and I trained and worked with them, representing the Air Force in their activities. At that time, see, we were always concerned about what would happen if we had to turn the birds loose, you know, the silos.
Silos, yeah, in case.
What can happen to the people that are... We're doing all that.
Mm-hmm.
We were working to see how many people would be available to the guard for whatever kind of help they needed in case of emergency.
Sure.
They worked on that. I was surprised that you did as much with it.
Well, there was quite a bit of activity at that time, relationship to civil defense and all those silos there for the Dew Line.
Plus you had, like June's mother was a airplane spotter, took the job very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You could call in anything that came over.
The
lodge. And I worked with the called the Ground Observer Corps. I worked with them for about 3 years, too.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of my duties that I assigned to my reserve.
Well, Dana, you had two sons, is that right?
Yes.
One of them followed you into the Air Force, is that right? Why don't you tell us a little bit about how that happened?
Well, David, my older son, all the time that I had been doing this recruiting, he's watching all this, and he decided he wanted to be in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that his eyes were good. Mm-hmm. That didn't bother him. I said, you know, you're never going to be a pilot. Mm-hmm. You don't have good enough eyes to do it. Well, I knew something from him. He stayed. He retired as a lieutenant colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was a great, if he would have stayed, he would made general, but he was tired. And they were at that period when they were shutting down Patch Barracks and all these places overseas.
Oh, yes.
Squeezing everything out.
Reduction, yeah.
And the same old story. You know, get rid of everything you can because you need the money for something else.
That's right. Well, when you retired out of the... What did you retire at?
Lieutenant
Colonel, too. That,
a lot of confirmation. She said, boy, I'm lucky. I've got two retired colonels in the same family. I said, I can't win or lose.
Yeah.
And then, of course, she... my daughter is the oldest one. She ended up in the military as a hospital blood manager in Europe.
In Europe.
Frankfurt.
Yeah.
So she was there from 76 to 92, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And in that process, we got to see a lot of country that we've never seen.
Sure.
She's the best travel agent I have had. But she, of course, is retired now. She is forensics.
Okay.
DNA and so forth.
Stuff, yeah.
And she retired at the Department of Safety Department of the State of Arizona.
And your other son is teaching?
And your other son is teaching. He's a big, tall coach. And he has 2,400 eyes. I don't want my kids to have good eyes.
Is that right?
Dave ended up after he studied all the time. He knew that was going
to
happen.
That was going to happen to
his
eyes.
But Pauline never had any eyes. Yeah. And Tom is the same boat.
Can't fly if you don't have good eyes.
He's a coach.
Doing well.
He's also represented the Governor's Council on Recreation from Gillette, Wyoming. Just got a grant to build a brand new course for kids.
Golf course. Great. Great. So
16 years and under.
Good.
And he said that's the best place we ever have to find a recruit for good players in Wyoming.
For Wyoming. And one other thing that people might be interested in, you went back to Germany then after you bombed it out several years later. You went back and looked up some of these places. Any comments or any observations that you'd like to share?
Well, I got to see a lot of Germany because we're moving these, we call them trolley missions.
Mm-hmm.
We take crews overseas, let them see what the bomb damage was. Like
yeah.
If I were Big B, all you see is nothing.
Rubble, yeah.
Just rubble. And so that the ground people had some feeling for what they had accomplished, being able to keep us in the air. So I got to see some of that before. Mm-hmm. And then I also got to see all of the damage, the bomb damage in Coventry and all those places when we were still flying.
Sure.
You know, when I look back now, these people are crying about how bad it is. They should have seen that place. They made a mess out of it. Coventry and all those places over there. And they just lived through it and they were still tough. But I think that actually when I went to the town to see where the folks were from, I was hampered because my German was lousy.
Wasn't good enough.
But I took my daughter along, and then, and she was speaking pretty good German, so we got back pretty good.
It was the village unscathed?
We went to a village, got to the village, and found out Miss Helma Schrupp, who had a little conditorei, or store. And we kept in touch. The first time we was out there, we had a green license plate, which is Air Force, U.S. Forces in Germany.
Yeah.
And, so nobody answered the door. It was probably our fault because it was on a Sunday.
Okay.
So next time we went back, well, we made sure every day in the store was open. And then we visited her and she would talk to us. And she said, you have to have Mönchengladbach. Mönchengladbach was the little village. Mönchengladbach line. We did a lot of that, and of course, the kids have lived on the colony, so we got to know quite a few people.
Sure,
And the same thing with my son, who got his PhD in Vienna.
Yeah.
He did all his work in German.
Would have to, yeah.
And my dad, I think, would have really been proud if he could have spoke German to my son. Because I think they would have had a great time talking to each other.
It worked that way.
Mm-hmm. And of course, he came back retired.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In England, the Air Force did. Yeah.
They had 40,000. Anyway, they had almost 27,000 casualties.
That's
a high number for what this was. The Swinford mission, half of them were dead.
Half of them didn't
make it. And see, this happened a lot of times. They found out they were going to have to fight it. All the way.
Cover all the way.
We're going to lose the battle on attrition.
Sure, just knocking them out of the sky. And
it was taking them out of the sky. And then they got the G, Model G, which had a chin turret. And that really added a lot of flexibility to their firepower. Instead of having these straight-in shots, they would come in and dive underneath them. And Walter, when they probably didn't even know they were there, already passed.
Yeah.
He's probably worrying about what's coming up in the back.
Did you ever fly beyond fighter cover, or did you have fighter cover on your missions? When you went to Frankfurt, that should have been beyond fighter cover.
And we didn't have it. We had a lot more flak. I remember one time we were flying to Reims on a mission into Germany. And they decided to do something fancy. They hiked something on the ground at Reims, Germany. So they did a formation over Reims. And it was like anything that was so messed up in all my life. Oh, you talk about a snafu? They had it. And we ended up finally getting ready to go into the bomb, getting on the line for the bomb run, the lines. And look out here, here's an airplane over here. I never saw the tail before in my life. He's hacked onto us. And that's what happened. And then the G and the stuff that would normally be dumped off so that when you hit the battle lines, where the guns would be starting to show, the chaff and the G was already floating into them. But we went to Reims, and that didn't get done. So when we started out, we were in trouble from the day from the minute we left because we had no protection. And we lost lots of planes on that one, just to show Ike
how good we were. Some second level commander wanting to show off to the general.
As I would send them back a Stars and Stripes. From the week that I got. And then they knew, they could see where the 8th Air Force had been. But not, it was not telling them anything.
No.
But they had to deduce that from the Stars and Stripes that I center. They had to figure out that that's where we were at.
That's where generally where you were at.
So that we were on that particular bomb bomb run. And they got pretty good at it. I didn't.
And a little different than today. You just sit down at the computer and communicate back and forth. But the Stars and Stripes, though, that was a pretty good
thing. Stars and Stripes was a pretty good thing. I mean, I'm sure that it had a bunch of liberal guys that I think of it now, but they were trying to do the best they could for the people.
You know what they had
and
going.
You had people like Ernie Pyle and those guys.
Moon Mullins, okay.
I think if I had to do it over again, I would probably do the same thing. I wasn't that disappointed. I was scared a few times, but I've been scared lots of times.
That's what war is about.
But I was fortunate. So it's happened to me. I came home, found a wife.
A good family and a good job.
And I can't complain.
Yeah, no more.
Even if Brandy didn't, he even remembered who I was.
When he refers to Doc Rennie, that Doc was the president. He remembered who he was.
He knew us all.
He had a perfect memory.
Strand was still because of my first position.
When you first started
and then
school.
Then and then became the substitute, I guess, and then you finally became the president. Mm-hmm. But when we left the service, or left to the service, he was acting president. But I always enjoyed listening to it.
Great. Well, hey, thanks so much, Dana, for taking the time out of your schedule to do this oral interview for the MSU Billings project, working with the honor students there. And I'm sure some of the students will find it very interesting as they listen to it. And if some of them want to call you and ask you some things this fall, would you be willing to...
You just catch me.
You just catch Dana a little bit. So if it's okay... Could I borrow this to get it scanned, to get a copy of this picture, or would you rather not do that?
Oh,
it's okay. I've got a picture of Dana and his flight crew here, so I'll scan a copy of that. So thanks again, Dana, so very, very much.